What I'm going to talk to you is about an effort that's called Communities Count. And this is an indicator report that's been around since about 2000 with some development done before that, that I think is an example of an attempt to really talk about social determinants of health and ways to measure them. I have nothing to disclose. So what I'm going to try and do in this 15 minutes is go over a little bit about our partnership and the process for selecting these community indicators, some of the selected indicators and methods, and I'm going to cruise through that pretty quick just to show you some high points of the different kinds of data we have available, and then finally a few examples of how we've tried to move from data to action, which is really the mission of this effort, is to take this information and to drive it toward action. So our partners are listed here, and you can see it's a range of partners that include City of Bellevue, Renton, Seattle, several different departments of King County, including Public Health, which is a combined city and county department, as well as Sustainable Seattle, the Seattle Foundation, and the United Way of King County. The role for Public Health in this effort is to be lead on collecting, interpreting, and disseminating the data. So the effort is really a partnership that is owned by this group of partners. It is not explicitly a public health report, but public health does the technical work for it. The process to get to this report was a very interesting one, and I want to spend a few minutes about that. Basically, in the late 90s, there was a real interest in looking at, we had daily updates on what was going on with economic indicators, we were very focused on environmental issues, but there were a few reports that really spoke to the health of people and communities in a broad sense that got beyond health outcomes and causes of death. So what this effort was initially to do a broad community survey that actually sampled 1,500 residents. It was a random digit dial survey, which as a result missed a lot of people who don't speak English. It was conducted in English only, and it also has problems with underrepresentation, as most telephone surveys do. As a result, we conducted a series of about 13 different focus groups with limited English speaking populations, with completely non-English speaking groups in their languages, as well as with homeless people and other groups that were likely to be underrepresented in surveys. The combination of looking at that community survey as well as the focus groups was pulled together in a way that we looked at what people liked about their communities and neighborhoods and what they were concerned about in their communities and neighborhoods. That became the real focus for the development of these indicators, with the idea being that we wanted to track what people cared about and wanted to see measured over time. Then it was a very iterative process, and that's what this diagram shows you. So we had technical advisors across not just public health, but included people with police and law and justice background, people that were civic activists. We had some academic people as well as some public health people to really help look at how do we select indicators that really track these things that people care about that are both reliable and valid, can be replicated over time with the idea of this is something we would continue to do. We conducted local forums that were more community leader types to really help to do some visioning about what were the values we were trying to achieve that were informed by these community survey and focus group data. And then ultimately selected a set of indicators that has now grown to be 38 indicators across six domains. And so this is a process that we've now continued to produce reports and actually do more frequent updates. So what I'm gonna do now is go pretty fast through a number of the domains and show just a few examples of some of the data that are in here. So the first one I'm going to show you is something we've just done. We're now doing monthly updates on recession-linked indicators. And they're focused on things like food and housing and bankruptcy filings and housing foreclosures and so forth to really get a flavor of how our community's doing. What you can see here is even though Seattle and King County were sort of lagging in housing foreclosures, and we're still certainly not a hotbed of foreclosures, we're exceeding where we were going in 2009 already through August of 2010, and I think we actually hit the Realty Track news as being highlighted as one of the cities that's still showing increases in foreclosures. So we're showing a little bit of a lag, and we have some concern in this area. What we've also done is tried to then map out, and this will give you a sense of King County, so you can see the area right here, the city of Seattle is actually a fairly small part geographically of the entire county. It's a very large county. In Communities Count, we tend to report information by the city of Seattle, the East County, the North County, and then South King County. This particular, and where we can do things in smaller area, we do. So this is actually looking at, in addition to housing foreclosures, what's going on with people who have troubled loans. This is an early warning system that's put out by HUD. So you can see here, there are these pockets in orange that are showing concerns, and you can also see that where we have the most problems with the darker colors are a lot concentrated in this part of the county and here, which is South King County. Our suburban cities now are having a big influx of more communities of color, more low-income people. It's where there's affordable housing. These things go together. This is where people have troubled loans. It's not by accident. It's by the way this whole system was set up, and the many things you've heard about in this conference about the injustices of the way people were put into the type of loans that really set them up for being in trouble with their loans and put into high risk and problems with maintaining loans. Another thing we've done with each report, because when you ask people what they want to see tracked over time, these 38 indicators we selected that track what people want to see in many times aren't available in administrative data sets. So we've had to perpetuate doing a community survey every time we do a formal update of the content. And that means we keep having this problem of underrepresentation, and we're trying to overcome that by, one, having the survey done in other languages, particularly in Spanish, which is the second highest language spoken in our county. And then we're also doing a qualitative research project with each report. So in the 2008 report, we looked at the interface of affordable housing, transportation, and quality of life. And this is some interesting themes. So who we interviewed were about 40 people. We did interviews in English, Spanish, Chinese, and Vietnamese, a cross-section of people that were between 50 and 120% of median income, so reasonably low middle-income people for the most part. We found some common views that were very informative to put along with the quantitative data we have about transportation and housing. But we found people really care about time in their lives, that they're trying to make ends meet and oftentimes having long commutes to have to, because they live away from where they work, to find affordable housing, that they want opportunities to be involved, that they want a flexible schedule, the opportunity to telecommute, that the transportation infrastructure isn't working for them in our county. And most importantly, when we go out and do reports to city councils across the county, we have 39 cities, so we get out to a number of city councils, we tell them what people told us is the things you invest in from a public policy perspective, parks and libraries and open spaces and community centers, these are the things that help people in your community make ends meet. They're really important to maintain. So it really helps in pointing to the value of these things to policymakers. Another income measure, we have, since 2000, we had in this report a measure of income inequality. We use the Gini coefficient. We look at quintiles of income. I'm not showing you that data because I think we all know the story there of the growth in the top 20%, same in King County. What this slide, though, is showing is something I think that's very dramatic. This is median income by race, ethnicity as a percent of white median income. In King County, the blue bars are for 2000, the grape-colored bars are for 2007, and you can see there that African-American median income between 2000 and 2007 went from 63% of white median income to 51%. This is ahead of the current economic decline, and what it's telling us is people that were working in those middle quintile and lower quintile level incomes that have those incomes haven't been doing well for quite a while. And this is also telling us, because of this being a ratio of white income, that many more white people are in that top 20%. We try to go on to explain to people when we show this data so as to not to reinforce people's negative narratives about what they might think about why that is, that there's a lot of studies that are showing us that there isn't fairness in the way people get hired for jobs. We have evidence of that. So we're trying to frame this in a way that we don't have people saying, well, that's because of this or this or this, but really to say this is about unfairness and some institutional racism problems in our communities. We also have a measure of discrimination in this report. We use Nancy Krieger's ProCardia discrimination questions that ask questions both about the type of discrimination and the place of discrimination. This shows for 2007 how that distributed. It's very obvious that there's a lot more discrimination reported by other races than by whites, by Hispanic and Latinos, by low-income people relative to people making over $50,000. For every indicator, we report differences when they're statistically significant by income, by race, ethnicity, by education, and by whether people live alone or in a couple relationship. And so this is one where there clearly are these differences. We also show small area analysis, and as we've been doing this survey over 4 points in time, we're able to combine years to look at how this distributes. So this is showing us how the self-reported experience of discrimination distributes across all of the health planning areas within King County, and you can see it's quite a difference. And that's been useful as well in showing it to people in various communities where they show high levels of discrimination. One of our cities actually chose to do some training with their employees when they saw this. They were quite taken aback by how high their city looked in terms of report of discrimination. The next section, we have some information on positive development through life stages. I'm just going to show you one indicator in this one, which is family-friendly employment benefits. And this one really underscores a couple of things. One, look at the bars for the grape-colored bar that's paid sick leave, and you can see there's a steady decline in paid sick leave. Mm-hmm. We really used this in talking about H1N1 and said, how can we tell people to stay home when they're sick when there's a significant proportion of people who don't get paid sick leave, and what are we going to do about that? And we actually have a group that we're funding that's trying to get an ordinance passed within the city of Seattle that would require paid sick leave for all employers above a certain number of employees. So we're trying to prompt that kind of action to get people to take action. You can also see there's a decline in everything going on as the economic situation is deteriorating. I'm going to show you one quick thing in the built-in natural environment. You can see about two-thirds of our people commute alone, and then we ask a series of questions in our survey that ask about people's satisfaction with their use of transit and their commute times. And what it tends to tell us is that there's some problems in terms of our South County and East County in terms of their use of transit, but they also are very unsatisfied with transit. The system doesn't work well for them. And so this has been helpful, again, to show to policymakers to say, you know, this transportation system, when we did our qualitative study as well as in this survey question, just isn't working well for people. So what are we doing with all this information? I'm not showing you the health and safety domain because I think you're all very familiar with that kind of data, but I can tell you what we don't have in it is leading cause of death and a lot of health-specific data as much as things such as obesity, more risk behavior information, as well as we have a perceived neighborhood safety as well as actual crime, which is quite interesting because even though we hear so much about crime, people's perception of their neighborhood safety is actually quite high. So what we've tried to do with this information is to get it out there. So it's been used quite a lot in terms of grant acquisition and by our local philanthropy. We have 11 funding partners that include a lot of our major foundations, and they actually claim to use the data to help inform their investments. It's also informed some budget decisions. We had a city that put money into early childhood development and an organization in their community that works on that because of the early learning information we have in the report. And it also helped to inform King County's Equity and Social Justice Initiative, and that's a whole other presentation that I actually did yesterday, but this persistent inequality data that we have in this report dating back to 2000 has really been helpful to drive the need to do something about it. We also, as I indicated, we're funding some local collaborations, the one I mentioned on the living wage ordinance and another one looking at a statewide effort to eliminate child poverty in our state that's really focusing initially on policy assessment. We're also working on a more dynamic website. We plan to have only a social web presence and not a hard copy report and have more social media presence. So that was very fast, and if you are interested in seeing more, I urge you to go to the communitiescount.org. It's rather interesting to look at these monthly updates, especially if the 2009 recap gives a sense of these broad data that I think we really can use to show the significance of some of these social determinants on health and well-being. Thank you.
So we would like to throw the floor open to questions and comments. An eager hand, yes?
I have a question actually for anybody who cares to answer. I work with an organization that serves American Indian tribes, and we've done a lot of community profiles similar, you know, at a lower level. we're very careful to report back to the community, but very reluctant to publicize results outside of the community because of concerns that local people have about being stigmatized for their own experience. And, you know, there's already some ideas about the community. So I'm wondering if you encounter any resistance in your experience with the community initially, and what you think the role of that publicity has been in following up on this very thing.
Would anyone, please come up to the mic. And did everyone hear the question? The question is, when we find these disparities, which are bad news for marginalized, vulnerable communities, what do we do? Because on the one hand, we want to tell the communities about it. On the other hand, we don't want to further stigmatize those communities. And so how do we move forward in that case? Did I summarize what you said? Okay.
Yes, but I'd also really like to know how important you think that publicity is in making a difference in the policy.
Okay, so and then how important is that negative publicity that would come from it?
No, but, I mean, any publicity, like you've had a lot of publications
right.
About
okay.
Studies.
Have great.
They had an important role in making a difference?
So let me try and speak to that. We have an indicator I didn't show you on teen births, and what we show in our county is while teen births are down, and it's a really good news story in many cases for Latina young women, teen births are up. What we did about that is we didn't want to just put that information out without having conversations with leaders within the Latino community and say, what do you think is going on behind this? How helpful is it to put a spotlight on this, and how should we deal with this? So I think it's really important to be working with communities around putting that kind of information out. Another report that I didn't present about, but we did a Pacific Islander health report that when you disentangle Asians from Pacific Islanders, there's some huge inequities in the way some of the health outcomes play out. And we, again, met with leaders within the Pacific Islander community to help with how do we put this information out in a respectful way and in a way that it gets noticed and with a driving toward action. Sometimes the challenge is not every community, not every member within a particular community views things the same way. So you may have very different perspectives, and it, I think, is important to reach out and figure out who are the community leaders that really can create a constituency and take the information and run with it and pay attention to what they have to say.
Can I also answer? So in our projects, we have community residents working with us pretty closely, and so when we provide data and report back on the work, and particularly since we're funded through both the city and the county. We report to the Board of Supervisors. We have community residents report back on the progress of the work that they're doing. And so that also is really important, having the community themselves be part of the data gathering. So the youth work that we've done, it was actually a youth-to-youth survey. And so Sandra, Dr. Witt over there with us just let me know that the city council funded, what, $5 million for a teen center. And a lot of that work came from the youth survey that said we really need more, we need a youth center in West Oakland. And so the youth were the ones that presented that data to the Board of Supervisors and to the city council, particularly their city council member. And it did make a difference. Okay, so I'm going to talk about something else that was really hard. There was a reporter on health inequities in our two initiatives, and particularly in Sobrani Park, and that article won an award. And one of the neighborhood residents was furious. And the reason why she was furious was because she, and then this, so this is based on what she told me. She said the article talked only about how bad we are. The article talked about how poor we are, how, you know, all those things. And the reporter did not pay any attention to when I told her of all the things that we're doing to address those issues. And so she's just absolutely furious. And I felt really bad because I was one of the people that allowed entree of the reporter into that community. And I think that if I don't have and I didn't have a really, really good relationship and they trust me, I, as a local health department representative, would not be what do you call it? I don't know whether they would kick me out or kick us out, but it would certainly cause a lot of, you know, difficulty in those kinds of relationships. So I do think that we have to be very, very careful and thoughtful about how we present data. And I also work a lot with Native American communities, and it is a hard one. So I think the framing of why those, why that data shows the kind of inequities that they show, it has to be framed around the social historical conditions that have brought people to those places. So there is an organization called Applied Research Center, and I really encourage you all to look into that organization, because they have a whole framework of how they how they talk about conditions, diseases, and so forth, where they have a four-step method and approach. And one of the most important thing to remember in their approach is to frame data around, I mean, based on the social and historical conditions, and to let people, I mean, and to include what is being done about those things.
I would just like to ask one brief thing, and then we'll go just in response to what you said. I mean, one thing that we've tried to do is, when in preparation to announcing the news, is to have programs or proposals in place which will make things better. So we're not just coming forward and saying bad things. So for example, Ami showed you some of the smoking data and some of the publicity we got out of it. And when we were at that press conference, I made clear, you know, that the state was being negligent in not providing any of the tobacco settlement funds for tobacco. You know, I mean, they were using it to build prisons and stuff like that. And the next day, I got a call from the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health saying, all right, we'll fund something. And then Dr. Joseph West, who's sitting here, was able to head up that program. In the same way, when we went to Humboldt Park, we knew we were going to release these very high diabetes rates for Puerto Ricans. And we didn't, again, want to just show the bad numbers. So along with Dr. Stephen Rothschild from Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, we formed a diabetes task force. And then at the same press conference in which we announced the bad data, we announced the findings from the task force and ways that we were going to solve the problem. And Dr. Molly Martin is sitting back here from Rush University, and we did the same thing with her with respect to pediatric asthma and so on. So I think it is incumbent, we've all agreed on that, no one in this room would disagree, but, you know, on how we have to make things better. And I think if we're going to announce data that show bad things, bad data in that sense, then to the extent we can announce programs which are going to remediate, ameliorate the situation, that's terrific. Right. Yes, sir.
Are there any opportunities for reductions in healthcare expenses when these strategies for improving social determinants of health are successful? And the reason I'm asking that question is, it seems like savings in the healthcare delivery system could be a potential funding stream for right-sizing the healthcare delivery system, for funding some of the public health initiatives that you're working on. And I'm wondering what kind of infrastructure is necessary to capture the surplus.
That's a great question.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think as the interventions are developed, for instance, there's a case study in the book that was written up on the asthma project, and they did exactly that. There's a cost-benefit analysis that was done, and they found that there was reduction in asthma hospitalization rates, and as a result, the hospitals were saving money, obviously, and that money could then potentially be used for other prevention and other work. So, and I think the same case with the diabetes management. As you start to manage diabetes from your home, then you don't have to go and visit the doctor for later stage diabetes issues. So I think there's absolutely potential for it. And I think the evaluation component of when you do interventions, I think a lot of times community-based interventions are done and the evaluation is there, but not, you know, I currently manage a breast cancer project, for instance. We do a lot of outreach in the community, but then, you know, really evaluating how that outreach is then resulting in going to see a doctor and preventive care, and then, you know, the linkage to services and, you know, this transparent evaluation of all interventions is just essential. And I think adding the component of how it saves money is very important to do, and clearly does have an effect. So I think just a matter of measuring it. I'm not sure if there are other cases like that. You know, we work for a hospital, like I said, so I don't know if the health department is doing that at all, but are there other people that want to respond to that? New York, yeah.
I'm definitely not the right person to talk about it from the health department, but I know just hearing the asthma story, I think having the local level data becomes incredibly persuasive. And what you can do is, if you have a demonstration project that we've had the similar outcomes and we've saw cost savings for asthma intervention programs to reduce hospitalizations and emergency room visits. But then what's really powerful about having the local level data is then you can model that, right? So if we did it here, if we did it in this community with these people, these are the numbers. We have the hospitalizations data from this other communities. We know this about the community, and we can start plugging in numbers and coming up with estimates that can be robust enough to be really persuasive to policymakers. And I think that's really where this local level data becomes so essential, because we can hone it, we can control for a lot of the variability, because then people can't just say, oh, it's just this, or it's just that, or it's just this. We can say, this is the rate in neighborhood A, this is the rate in neighborhood B, this is the rate in neighborhood C. We did intervention X in neighborhood C, and it changed if we did it here and there. So I think that's where the data becomes incredibly powerful and persuasive for us as a health department, for legislatures who want to push for certain budgetary decisions, and for communities to argue, like, you know, we need this service. So I think that's the real power. I mean, it's a real... You have to be very careful with the data, and I think we try to be, and I think I'm sure you guys have the same experience, but to empower people to use that data in ways that maybe we can't do directly. So we are giving you the data, they can use it, and I think one of the key areas that we're really starting to push for is using the data to demonstrate cost effectiveness or potential health impacts or cost savings, maybe to some extremes in some cases. But I think that's where it becomes very powerful, and I don't think we had that 10 years ago.
I would add just one more thing, that we not lose sight of keeping to push on the causes of the causes. So if we think about asthma, and we think about housing, and we can think about managing in the home, but how about the quality of housing to begin with? How about leaky, substandard housing that contributes to molds? How about houses that have cheap fans, that have poor ventilation, that result in moisture accumulation and mold development that contribute to triggers to asthma? So I think we don't want to lose sight of there's some costs with addressing the causes of the causes that ultimately will save in the healthcare system. But to think it's a one for one, or that we should only be eyeing saving on hospital costs, would seem to me missing the causes of the causes piece. So I think it's one of those both and. We need to do both. Mm.
If I can be kind about policymakers, I think they're notorious for being impatient. I think that it's very interesting to hear some of the things that you've been doing, but I'm very curious to find out, how long have you been working with your communities? How much have you invested in time and effort and people and resources? And what sorts of things do you expect to get out of that, and when? I'm an evaluator, so I'm trying to get at some of that outcome evaluation data that is so difficult to get in public health, and particularly when you're dealing with chronic diseases like asthma and diabetes and heart disease and those sorts of things.
Well, let me try, and then maybe some of people from the audience can comment. I mean, I think that's a great question, and in fact, really, to me, it's the overarching question that really matters the most. What we're trying to do in Chicago and the communities in response to the survey is put these interventions, these programs in place, and then use the hardest of all outcome measures we can find. So for example, Joseph, could you raise your hand? Dr. West is leading a diabetes program in North Lawndale, which is an all-black community that Mount Sinai is located in, and the outcome measure there is hemoglobin A1C. And we have stated in advance, if hemoglobin A1C does not go down, we will have failed. I mean, hopefully we'll learn things, but we've selected deliberately a hard outcome measure. In the pediatric asthma program that Amin mentioned, we selected number of hospitalizations, number of appearances in the emergency department, number of school days lost, and other things like that, some paper and pencil tests, and on and on. So I agree with you. I think it's absolutely urgent that when we use these programs, we find hard outcome measures, that we evaluate them carefully, and that we be fully transparent, so that if we're not successful, we not run and hide, but we make that clear as well. I don't know if that was an answer.
Well, it's sort of an answer. I think the next part of that answer would be, when would you expect to see outcomes in those areas from the intervention that you're
right.
doing? If you put in 3 years and those numbers haven't moved yet, if Dr. West has been working in that neighborhood for 5 years now and the A1Cs haven't moved yet, when would you think they wouldn't? But I know I've talked with Tony Ike in Alameda County, and he's talked about a 10-year time frame from beginning to when he expects
right.
to see some of those outcomes.
Great point. I see. Can I just ask Dr. West to come in?
I want to respond. I think right now is a very interesting time period for community mental public health. For example, in the Wall Street Journal, we were talking about how tobacco cessation is taking a huge leap backwards because states are short of money and they stopped investing in smoke cessation programs. And now you start to see the smoking rates go up. What you're also seeing is with neighborhoods is that, especially when you look at data, the data you have in 2007, as people are losing their income, losing their homes, these communities are changing.
Yeah.
So even with our community in North Lawndale, we have twice a year, I mean, talked about that, we hold community forums. And so we just had a community retreat this October. One of the things that came out of the retreat was people saying, hey, you know, the people who are invested in this community have been here a long time. They're aging. They're the activists. Some of the people who are moving into the community, they don't see it as their community. They're just moving in here because they moved from outside. And so the question now they're asking is, how do you get them invested in that sense of community and neighborhood
yeah.
with a lot of this mobility in and out? So you have this kind of storm of community-based interventions where communities are being reshaped in real time, along with policy, along with challenges around budget issues and what we're going to invest in. We're actually only about 10 months into our diabetes initiative, and the community has kind of started to galvanize around that. But it's only certain organizations that are doing that have long-standing investment in people who have been doing it for a long time. But now you have this question of new people moving in and how do you engage them.
Right.
And you're starting to see this this change. So even in 10 years, how different will the community look in 2020 as opposed to today?
Yes.
I have a question regarding access to the data. I hear that you want people to use the data in a respectful manner, but how do you manage that? Because can anybody just come up and access your data?
Yes.
Could you come just up to the line?
For New York City, we have we have summary reports, and we have tables, and we have this EpiQuery system where you can actually just put in queries and get data and tables done. But for other people who want more detailed data, there is a public use data set that is downloadable with SAS code that's downloadable with a code book. It's heavily documented, and we ask people to enter into a data use agreement, and you agree to what, you know, kind of how to use the data and how to report it and tell us how you're reporting it and how you're using it. But that's basically it. And if you want data fields that are not available in the public use data set, you can make a special request and that would require IRB and things like that. But we've also done that for researchers. So we have, I mean, really admirably, I have to say, for that bureau, because it's a huge amount of work, but really tried very hard to get the data out to people so that they can use it. And I think then you have to just kind of let go of it at some point, and you can always respond to how people use your data.
And then the follow-up to that is, we've had lawsuits around language and some other issues that have come up, especially in hospitals. I'm wondering if there's been any lawsuits around race and ethnicity that you're aware of, where people
I don't know of any. Wanted to comment also on both of your responses. I think that is some of the stuff that we started to measure. In fact, as I mentioned to you earlier, that the community is the ones, they're telling us what we should measure. And so it isn't always individual behavior. That isn't what they're looking for. And I think some of those measures that Sandy had also touched on are these, you know, putting health on the agenda and raising it, as Steve always says, putting it on the social consciousness of the community. And as you start to do that, and all of our interventions are doing that, I think, I mean, slowly, but very, I mean, on the other hand, sometimes you see it very quickly. As I mentioned, you know, one of the projects that I also work on, like I mentioned, is the breast cancer. And, you know, just having a walk in the community where women are allowed to come out and celebrate, I mean, they are now asking us to do that again. They're coming out and saying, you know, we do need to get our mammograms. Yes, I'm afraid, but they're talking about it. And there's actually a quote in the New York Times article about this woman, Leonie Calderon, and she is one person who, you know, stood up and said, gosh, you know, obesity was an issue in her community, and she felt it was a personal issue all of a sudden. And so she took it upon herself to start a walking club, and now has an exercise routine twice a week at the local park district, where she has probably 20, 35 women that come, and they exercise with her, every week, twice a week. That piece of this is missing in our interventions. I mean, it's really hard to measure how communities take ownership of the data, take ownership of the issues, and decide to do something on their own. I mean, that's not us doing something. That's the community doing something. And that's the most important, I think, in the end. If you want to see sustainable, healthy populations, that's what you have to see, is that each of us doing our part and not outsiders coming in and telling them what to do. So I think there's sort of, our job is to create conducive environments so that the policymakers know what to do with the data so they can create an environment that's healthy for them. But so I don't know if that touches on.
Let me just say, it's always times like this when I have no idea what to do. It's 3 minutes after four. I personally can stay here for the next 24 hours. If people would like to stay and talk, I just think that's great. And if others of you need to move on, we would certainly understand that. But please.
Yeah, just to say, because I'm an evaluator too, and I have the same problem. And I think, you know, we have all of this data now that we've become slaves to the data, right? So we have to say, this is what we're going to do, this is what it's going to change, this is how it's going to be, blah, 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 blah. And then when it doesn't happen, we're accountable for that. So I think it's managing expectations on the part of us as evaluators, so that I work with programs and they have to set targets. So the cancer program wanted colonoscopy rates. They were 32%. And I said, what's your target for next year? They're like, oh, 50%. I said, no, it's not. Your target's 34%. You know, and I think it's educating people about what is a significant change and where you can change and where you get plateaus and where, you know, and I think that's something in New York City that we did, I think, with our legislators, with our communities, to say what is progress. But I think we're getting a lot of that from a lot of areas, and a lot of it is BMI. So now we have those communities putting prevention to work grants, and they want to see change in biometric measures in 1 year. So it's kind of managing those expectations and talking about what are the moderators and what can we measure instead of measuring that, that we think that might show some change, but to show some amount of progress that is substantial, but maybe not, you know, shocking. So that's one of the examples, like with the colonoscopy was a great example because they had totally unrealistic expectations, but they wanted to put in their targets as X and to try to tell them that, no, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, I think that's a big question, and certainly we could talk offline as well, but the sampling, I mean, there's a confidence issue as well, right? So that's, I think, the main issue with regards to sampling. We did have some reliability issues around the Asian data in particular, especially when you give it back to the community, and they're like, that doesn't sound right. You know, so then you start to investigate a little bit further, and then you wonder, you know, sometimes if the way we ask the question made sense to them starts to become a question to us. Did we translate it appropriately? Was the interpretation correct? We were really thought, you know, we spent a lot of time in the initial Sinai survey, and we're able to do a lot of back translation in Spanish, both in the Puerto Rican community as well as Mexican community, where Spanish is different. So there's a lot of those types of methodological issues that did come up, which might question the reliability of the data, and certainly has its challenges. So I don't know if that's a good enough answer for now, and if you want to talk later, since there's others.
So I just want to let you know that we do have, I mean, we have the same issues, the methods, the methodology, and I think it's really important to know what it is that you're going to use the data for. So even though we have a convenience sample in all of the neighborhood you know, household surveys, the impact of the results from the surveys is that the community residents can use that data to present what their needs are to policymakers. So, and I think one of the things that's been really important in our Alameda County is that our Board of Supervisors have been educated over a number of years now on social determinants of health. There's one of the supervisors who has a whole project initiative called Health is Not Healthcare, or Not Just Healthcare. So I think over the years they've really understood, or they've come to understand, that it's not just, you know, health data that they're interested in, but they're also, and so that's why we try to focus on community data, you know, neighborhood conditions, and then encourage our community residents to be the ones to present the data. So it's very powerful because their constituents are talking to them. You know, they're the ones who are saying, this is what's happening in our community, this is what we're doing about it, and we want you to continue to support it, and in fact, you know, continue to fund the work that we're doing. So I think that speaks to, you know, whether you choose a particular method and, you know, how scientific you want it to be and so forth. Like, if we were to publish this stuff in a, you know, like in a journal, we really couldn't do it because we didn't do IRB, but it's for the community and for our work to really see whether we're making any progress or not.
Yes.
We do very creative. Two things. Let's see. So we've had Measure A funding, which is a county sales tax, right, Sandra? So it's a sales tax, and I think we get like half of a 50% of 1 cent of all. I can't remember if it's a particular revenue stream, and then on the city side we also have Measure Y, which is also 0.5 cent of another, and we had to vote on it. I mean, so I'm a resident of Oakland, so we made sure that, you know, we really voted for those funds. Now, it's not much. I don't know, Sandra, if you want to speak to any other creative funding that we do for this work. Yes. Yeah. And then we had H1N1 funding, so we said, well, household surveys, we could include H1N1 questions to fund that. So we just try and figure out how to pull funds from all kinds of places. We have very creative financing people. Finance.